The Energy Policy Committee will come to order. The first bill on our agenda is Representative Atkins' bill, House File 255.
Look, Madam Chair.
Oh, charts.
Yeah.
Where he's had press in the legislature.
For folks who came, I made these, well, I didn't really make this myself, but I had a hand in these. And actually, Madam Chair, if it's with your permission, I think I'll just stand and talk, whether we make a record or not. You know the line, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore? That fits what we've had going on with respect to our nuclear waste issue in across the country and here in Minnesota. What we have, and I think I'll let you folks read on with those, but as I give a verbal description, since 1982, the Nuclear Waste Fund was established in order to find a permanent repository for nuclear waste. That was supposed to have been done years ago. It's kind of like paying a garbage man to collect your garbage, and he never shows up, and you pay him for 30 years. That was 82. It's now 2013, and they have made zero progress. In fact, they've taken a step backwards because they were supposed to store it at Yucca Mountain down in Arizona, have now unfunded and moved away from the Yucca Mountain site. So currently we have no site, and yet they still continue to collect money from Minnesota ratepayers to the tune of something in the neighborhood of over $600 million with interest at this point. All that money does is go and sit in some account in Washington, D.C., apparently, because it's not being spent on the purpose that it's supposed to be spent for, which was to establish a permanent repository for this nuclear waste. But it gets even worse, and Madam Chair, if I might, I've got one witness, and then I'd like to just make some final comments about why it's worse. But Mr. Pickens is here on behalf of Xcel Energy and their ratepayers who've been paying into this fund for 30-odd years.
Great. Welcome to the Energy Committee, and before you give your testimony, just state your name and your affiliation.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. My name is Terry Pickens. I'm the Director of Nuclear Regulatory Policy for Xcel Energy. I'm hitting my 30th anniversary working for Northern States Power, now Xcel Energy, working in nuclear power. And for much of my career, I've been working on the spent fuel disposal projects associated with operating nuclear power plants and the policies down at the federal government. We, like Representative Atkins, share the frustration. His frustration, the frustration of the representatives here, as well as Minnesotans in general, for the lack of progress by the federal government in meeting their obligation and the funds that have been paid into the Nuclear Waste Fund. We have been working on this issue over the years. We have sought to look at the Nuclear Waste Fund and the monies that we are paying in. We have attempted to use those payments before as leverage to get the federal government moving. In fact, in its first lawsuit that NSP, now Xcel Energy, filed against the Department of Energy, one of the first things that we suggested was, in fact, escrowing the nuclear waste fund payments so that we could get the federal government, we could put pressure on the federal government to act, fulfill their obligation without the necessary money coming in. The courts did not find at that time that that was an appropriate action. So we've not done that. But discussions like this are important to keep attention on this issue and to remind the folks in Washington that, in fact, the states are paying attention, and we're pretty concerned that they have not fulfilled their obligation. In fact, just 3 weeks ago, as part of the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition, which is a group of public utility commissioners from around the country, as well as interested communities like Red Wing and the Prairie Island Indian community and utilities that are being impacted by this, we had a meeting and we made sure that we did a joint visit and went up and talked to members of the Minnesota delegation in Washington just to make sure that they know that this is important and that we need them to keep focus on this and begin to start taking some of the things that have happened recently and doing something with them. Representative Atkins and I, when we spoke, he said, if you could just hit a few things that are going on right now. We've taken a number of different avenues into trying to solve this. We've kept congressional focus on this in Washington, D.C. through things like the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition. Another important thing that we've done is the use of lawsuits. There's currently two lawsuits that are very important to moving the federal government along. One of them has to do with the nuclear waste fund fee. Utilities through the Nuclear Energy Institute have sued the Department of Energy, in essence, to set the rate of collection for the nuclear waste fund to zero, in recognition of the fact that the Obama administration has stopped progress on Yucca Mountain and that we don't have a real program moving forward at this point. The courts have expressed a lot of support for the suits that were brought. Very recently, the Department of Energy responded to the court by providing their version of a fee adequacy assessment, which says they need all the money that they're getting paid to solve the waste problem. The court, that depended heavily on the use of Yucca Mountain and the cost structure that they put there, the courts had previously told them, basing it on Yucca Mountain, when in fact they have zeroed out funding for that program, was not appropriate. So they have now reopened and invited all of the parties to again address its concerns to the court. And so we will be responding as an industry to them, trying to get them to finally take the action of setting the nuclear waste fund collection down to zero. The second lawsuit that's going on, and we expect a decision on very soon, has to do with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's review of the application from the Department of Energy on Yucca Mountain. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act specifies that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is in fact obligated to review the application when it's received from the Department of Energy. They have a specified period of 3 years to review that. They did not meet that obligation. They complained that they had not been appropriated enough funds from Congress, so they have now stopped their review. The industry, as well as some states and counties in areas like Washington State or Aiken County down in South Carolina, have filed suit and said, under federal law, you are obligated to complete that review. The court came out very strongly in a preliminary decision last year and said they agree that NRC is obligated under federal law to complete that review. They did give Congress the opportunity to maybe address the funding issues through appropriations. Nothing was put in place by Congress. The courts have now promised that if Congress didn't do anything, that they would issue their decision fairly quickly. So right now we are just waiting for the court to issue its decision, which we believe will be to direct the NRC to complete their evaluation of the application that's been submitted for Yucca Mountain. We are hopeful that when the NRC issues their safety evaluation report, finding that in fact Yucca Mountain was safe for storage up to 1 million years, that will take some of the wind out of the sails of the opponents of Yucca Mountain in Nevada, and perhaps we will see some kind of movement going forward on that. So those are the two court cases that have moved forward recently. We're hoping for decisions. Relative to the Blue Ribbon Commission report, that of course was issued in January of 2012. Congress asked the Department of Energy for their strategy to implement the recommendations. They finally issued their strategy in January of 2013. They've now indicated to Congress what authorizations they need in order to move forward with the Blue Ribbon Commission recommendations. And we are starting to see draft legislation coming out of both the House and the Senate side. I can't tell you that the House and the Senate are in complete agreement. There are large differences between the House and the Senate, but at least we're seeing draft legislation and it remains on the table, and we're hopeful that DOE will get the authorizations that it needs to begin to move this process forward again. So with that, those are really the actions with the Blue Ribbon Commission report, the court cases, and then the pressure that I've indicated that we've put on, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I have a couple questions, and then Representative Quam has a question. One, I'm wondering if you know whether there are other pieces of legislation like this one moving in other states.
Madam Chair, There has been a lot of discussion over the years, over using payments into the nuclear waste fund as leverage. The hesitation of a bill of this sort has come from because if we in fact stopped payments into the nuclear waste fund, we have a contract, Xcel Energy has a contract with the Department of Energy that was put in place in response to the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. We are obligated under that contract to continue paying, and if we stop payments, then we would be found in breach of contract. That would do a number of things. It would remove the federal government's obligation to dispose of our fuel, meaning that we would be standalone in Minnesota for taking care of our own waste. We wouldn't be part of the larger program. They inserted a clause in that contract that says that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission cannot take major licensing actions with regard to our nuclear power plants, like license renewal. We have a license renewal for our independent spent fuel storage installation pending. So if, in fact, we were in breach, the NRC could not renew the independent spent fuel storage installation license. And then finally, we are continuing on behalf of our ratepayers to seek damages from the Department of Energy. And if at any point we were found to be in breach, that would probably damage the litigation that we have against the Department of Energy to recover the monies that we're spending for dry fuel storage and those types of things at our plants. So, and most states have not gone after that type of legislation for those reasons.
Madam Chair, to that very same point, and you're a lawyer as well. We didn't breach this. The federal government breached this, which therefore, under the law, releases us from continued obligations to continue paying. They've had 30 years to make good, and they have done, not only have they done nothing, they've now taken steps backward. So if anybody's in breach, it's the federal government for failing to take the actions that have been required. And to have them continue to require us to pay in makes no sense. We did make one change, though. The first time this was introduced was 3 years ago, and it would have ceased payments from Minnesota ratepayers immediately. And Mr. Pickens made roughly the same comments back then, and he talked about pending litigation, that he's making the same sorts of comments today as we wait for the outcome of litigation. Let's not take anything away from Mr. Pickens. He's right on the mark. But obviously something has to change. We just keep beating our head against the wall and expecting some kind of different outcome. And if we don't take some sort of different action, so across the country now, as I've spoken with legislators, and I would ask you, Madam Chair, and other members of the Energy Committee to do the same, is ask your fellow state lawmakers from across the country to do what this approach takes, which is it doesn't immediately cease the payments. It gives them a couple more years, mm-hmm. and it tells the federal government, all right, you got two more years of rope in which to collect these. But at that point, if you haven't made any further progress, why in the world would we keep paying in to the tune of now what is over $500 per family in Minnesota? That's the kind of money that we're talking about. It's not $5 or $10. It's literally several hundred dollars per family that's been paid into this fund with zero to show for it. So to the extent you get an opportunity to share that with your lawmaking friends in similar positions across the country, that would be the ask today.
I think it's a great bill, and it's a great conversation to have. My second question is, who gets the interest? Right now we're shipping all this money to D.C., and $695 million attributable to Minnesota ratepayers, I'm assuming, generates some nice interest payments. Who is benefiting from the interest? Is that coming back home, or is that staying in D.C.?
Madam Chair, all the interest remains in the Nuclear Waste Fund, so we don't see any benefit of that either.
Maybe another idea for a bill. Representative Quam, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to better understand what adequate progress means and then the legal ramifications of that definition if this does go to court.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam, for the question. I think it kind of speaks for itself. I mean, we know progress when we see it. Right now, we know a lack of progress when we see it. If there is no further action by the federal government, which is actually the latest approach that they're taking, is tantamount to doing nothing. And if we continue to see that for two more years, which is what the bill spells out, for another year and a half, that only at that point would the payments stop. But otherwise, it'd be within the realm of the department to make that decision in terms of whether or not any progress is even, let alone adequate progress, is being made. I'm fearful that we're not going to see any progress at all.
Follow up, Representative Quam? No. Representative Polk.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Atkins, for bringing us forward to start a conversation. And I do think that, you know, with the total amount of dollars that have been put into this, just imagine if we actually put it on something that had a positive return on investment. We could have seen huge amounts of money spent into renewables or conservation efficiency or research and development. My question is, let's just say that, you know, the federal government goes along and agrees with us and says, all right, that's fine. We won't ask you to pay into this fund anymore. But the catch is that then you have to develop a long-term repository in your state because you're out of the federal program. Where in Minnesota should we locate that long-term repository?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, right now we are the long-term repository for nuclear waste. It's going nowhere. And I would suggest to you one thing, which is along the banks of the Mississippi River is not where we want it. So if folks have a better idea, but as we stand today, we have become by default the long-term repository for. And you'll notice, by the way, from some of these charts, we're now beyond the warranty life of these dry casts. It's a 20-year warranty, and we expect them to last longer. I'm not trying to have anybody get overly scared. But the fact is that's what has resulted, and anything has got to be better than storing that nuclear waste along the banks of the Mississippi River.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Atkins, for that. But, I mean, I've been continually reassured by the utility that it's temporary storage. So I mean, if you're saying it's long-term and they're saying it's temporary, what is it?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Well, it's a serious question. I mean, and I know actually, I mean, when we looked at the different places, you know, prior to the, you know, maybe pardon my language on this, it was a screw Nevada bill that, you know, allowed Yucca Mountain to move forward. They were looking at numerous sites in Minnesota because some of our geologic formations were deemed to be relatively stable. And so, you know, my concern would be that they would go and look back at those sites that were identified back in the 1980s, some of them in the granite deposits along the Minnesota River or some of the other sites up in the Iron Range, and say, well, you go and develop a long-term repository there because, you know, we started doing some of the groundwork and you don't want to pay into the federal solution, so take care of it at a state level. I mean, I do think that that is a potential backlash that we could face, and I think we should be cognizant of that. If Representative Atkins would, you know, care to comment, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Atkins.
Representative Falk, I'm equally concerned. Those were among the sites that were listed were in northern Minnesota. But I know one thing for sure is that having it along the banks of the Mississippi River is not where we want it. And to have it in temporary casks, which you're right, the utility will continue to assure you that it's temporary, but it's now been there for going on. I mean, nuclear waste fund started 30 years ago, and we've seen zero progress as a result of it. So it's a conversation that we've got to have, whether it's going to go to Yucca Mountain somewhere else, but it can't continue to sit in temporary casks along the Mississippi River, let alone the fact that we're paying in over $500 per family, $600 million, $30 billion nationwide into a fund that's doing nothing.
Mr. Pickens, did you want to comment on the question?
Yes, I just wanted to make sure that everybody understands, Madam Chair. Thank you. The 20 years, when we initially licensed this with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you are restricted to a 20-year license. The vendor, in fact, did put a warranty in place for that initial 20 years. At that point, we have to go back and relicense these casks with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That requires a detailed assessment of the capability of these casks to continue to perform their safety function for that extended period of time that we might use them. So while the warranty runs out, it's much like buying a car. You might get a 20,000-mile warranty on a car, but it's going to go for 100 or 150,000 miles. We have an independent safety regulator that licenses the safe storage of these casks on site. They've, in fact, looked at the 20-year license period for dry fuel storage, recognized that it will be safe for a long period of time, modified their regulations to even allow up to 40 years of license renewal, and there's a much longer period. So we will, with the NRC, periodically go back, revisit, and ensure that the next period of licensing, 20 or 40 years that these casks will remain safe and that we have the effective aging management programs in place such that it will continue to remain safe. If for some reason they found that these casks were coming to the end of their life, we would then be required to either replace them or somehow modify them and or put them inside of another canister, get them somewhere where they can in fact be taken care of. There are clauses in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act and the contract that we have with the Department of Energy that should you get to some type of emergent situation where it is no longer found safe, that they would take it to a national lab, something like that. So there are protections that we have in there, but these will be safe for a very long period of time.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, and I guess I apologize to the testifier. I don't have your name.
Mr. Pickens.
Mr. Pickens.
I thought at first Representative Atkins was bringing T. Boone Pickens. It's a different Pickens.
I did better.
Mr. Pickens, that raises some concerns for me. I mean, first and foremost is, you know, once the warranty period is expired and you do have a problem, who gets stuck with the bill? I'm assuming that gets passed on to ratepayers. But I've been familiar with the fact that you have a 20-year period there before you have to go and reinspect them. So when you open up a cask and inspect it, what do you do with the waste that's currently stored with inside that cask? Where does that get placed?
Mr. Pickens.
Madam Chair, Representative, in terms of having to open up the cask, at this point in time, when you fill a dry cask, what you do is you take it into the pool, you fill it underwater, you put the lid on, you then evacuate it and completely dry the cask on the inside of the dry cask, and then you backfill it with helium and inert gas so that you are having almost zero effects of aging in the internal parts of the cask. So there is no need to go in and do inspections. Any type of degradation that you might see would likely be occurring from the outside. So it's things like inspecting the coatings, ensuring that the metal on the outside of the canister is remaining intact. For systems that use concrete, you would look at the concrete, make sure that it's in good condition such that it protects the canister on the inside of the concrete storage, those types of things. So there is not a need to go in and do a detailed visual inspection. Where longer term you might get into concerns, we're already working with the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to develop research programs that would enable us to take an example cask, and we've done this before when we out at Virginia Electric, after they had a cask on their pad for 20 years, we transported that cask, they transported, to the Department of Energy facility. They took it into a hot cell that provided radiation protection. They were able to go in and do detailed examinations that confirm our belief that in fact there is no aging going on inside of the cask to either the cladding, the fuel itself, or to the internals of the cask, and that it will be in good shape for a long time. So we're already doing those types of things.
So you don't take the rods out, you just let them, I mean, you just assume that everything inside there is going as it should.
I mean, yes, and we've done supporting analysis on what we expect to happen, and then we use example casks like that one to confirm that our predictive analysis is in fact are correct so that we know what's going on inside the cask.
Representative Atkins.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to, on behalf of Mr. Pickens and myself, thank you and the members of the committee for giving us a little bit of time. I know you've got another important bill on the calendar this afternoon, but keeping this issue on the front burner here in Minnesota is very important, and I appreciate the opportunity to have it heard this afternoon.
Thank you. Representative Atkins, we do have two more member questions. Do you have time for two more member questions?
Yeah, I'm just sure. Trying to be understanding. I know that there were people that came here for your other bill, so
Representative,
I'd be happy
Horton,
to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mine's pretty quick, but this chart that you brought, Representative Atkins, is actually stunning. I mean, if people can't see it, Red Wing nuclear waste timeline, we go from 25 dry casks and 625 tons of waste in 2010 all the way up to 63 casks and 1,000 575 in 2035, and then way up to 98 and over 2,000 in 2045. It's very dramatic, and I would argue we shouldn't be producing this in the first place. What the definition of insanity is, keeping doing the same thing over and over again and then expecting a different result. And And so the fact is we have no place to store this, yet we keep producing it. But my question is, I think Representative Beard and I went to Yucca Mountain, I don't remember when that was, 7 years ago or so. And one fact that I remember from that trip that stuck with me, and I'd love for either you or Mr. Pickens to comment on it, is that even if by some very unlikely circumstance Yucca Mountain was licensed or someplace in Utah or wherever it would be, with all the nuclear waste in the country that's committed to go there, they still wouldn't have room. And at some point it would fill up relatively quickly. And so that means that there's still nuclear waste out there, maybe even in Prairie Island, that's not even going to be accommodated at a so-called permanent storage site. So I'm wondering if that's true, if you've come across that statistic, and if so, what's the plan B, even if, very unlikely, there is a permanent storage site, are we still going to be looking at permanent storage and here?
And Madam Chair,
Atkins.
And that Representative Hornstein, you illustrated, we don't even have a plan A at this point, let alone plan B, and that's my understanding as well. Mr. Pickens can probably, right down to the nub of it, can tell you how much capacity it has. But even once Yucca Mountain is complete and takes all the waste it can, we haven't solved the issue. That's how far behind the eight ball we are. But with that, I'll...
Mr. Pickens.
Madam Chair, Representative Horsey, you are correct. Currently, Yucca Mountain is limited by federal law to 70,000 metric tons. Current amount that we have produced from all of the plants to date is about 60,000 metric tons. So we are approaching the administrative limit. But the key there is that it's an administrative limit. If, in fact, if you review the environmental impact statement that was done for Yucca Mountain, it was done to the tune of about 150,000 metric tons, and there are some that believe that in the end Yucca Mountain will be able to take probably twice that much. Early on, Congress focused everybody on Yucca Mountain. They kind of stopped looking for the second repository. The original plan was two repositories, one east, one west. We'll look at it. They quickly focused on that. Many folks believe that as soon as Yucca Mountain is licensed, Congress will probably not want to go through that again. It will probably remove the legislative limit, and in the end, Yucca Mountain will have the full capacity to take everything that's being generated now and in the future from the existing nuclear power plants.
Thank you.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Most of my questions have been answered. Thank you, Representative Atkins, for bringing forth this bill. But I am wondering, you know, not to disparage our federal government, but once in a while they do raid funds. I'm just wondering, is all the money that has been paid into the nuclear waste fund still there?
Representative Atkins.
No, Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, I'm going to check. I hadn't.
Thank you, Representative.
That's a very good question.
Well, thank you, Representative Atkins. If you or Mr. Pickens want to make any closing comments, you're free to, but I think it was a great presentation of the issue, and I think we need to push the issue with the federal government because, like you so eloquently stated, nothing is happening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Pickens.
The next bill on the calendar is, I just posted the calendar for the day. The next bill on the Energy Policy Committee agenda is House File 1205. I will move that House File 1205 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to first thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to present this bill to you today. It actually passed in the Senate just last week and was sent to the General Register there as well. Representative Benson and I are the co-authors of this, and we aren't the only legislators that represent Plymouth. We also have Representative Winkler and Representative Lyndon Carlson that have a chunk of Plymouth. And this is our concern today. We're coming forward with a piece of legislation that is dealing with a proposed line that would run through Plymouth. It would change it from a 69-volt line to a 115-volt line, which is significantly larger. And this is running through different areas of Plymouth. Right now, current law says to have a certificate of need, your line, your proposed line, has to be 10 miles or longer. This line is 8 miles that they're proposing. However, the alternative routes that we're asking for them to consider are longer than the 10 miles, and so that's why we're coming forward with this piece of legislation asking that they have the certificate of need as part of the Hollydale project. That's all I wanted to say, a representative, Madam Chair, but I also wanted to have some testifiers from the community that have done a lot of research on this, if you don't mind, if that's all right.
Welcome to the committee, and whoever wants to testify, just first state your name and then provide your testimony, and we'll do questions at the end, and then we'll listen to any other testifiers who want to testify either against or just about the bill.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1205. My name is Paula McAbee, and I represent the Western Plymouth Neighborhood Alliance, and they are a group of citizens concerned that Xcel's proposed Hollydale 115 kilovolt high voltage power line would harm their homes, families, property values, and quality of life. We are grateful to Representatives Anderson and Benson for their co-authorship of House File 1205, and the Senate companion to this bill, which is co-authored by Senators Bonhoff, Rest, Limmer, and Osmek, unanimously passed out of committee last Tuesday. From our perspective, House File 1205 is critical to make sure that an unnecessary high-voltage transmission line is not built through the heart of a dense residential neighborhood in Plymouth and through some high-value wetlands that are located in both Plymouth and Medina, including wetlands of the Minnehaha Creek watershed. The current 69 kilovolt line that's in part of this area is not a used power line, and it's on smaller wooden poles that are much more in scale of the neighborhood. And there is, our group does not dispute that there is a growing need for electricity, but we went back and we read the documents that Xcel prepared in studying this project, and they did a Plymouth load serving study in November 2010, which went through the period of 2030. And they talked about an alternative that would build a new substation, but no high voltage power lines, only underground, low voltage distribution lines. And they said, and this is Xcel, and I'm quoting it verbatim, this alternative, which they called A2, quote, meets the various criteria by which planning engineers compared each alternative. And that was through to the period 2030. And we've had an electrical engineer who's in the neighborhood look through all the documents, and he agreed that this would be a feasible and prudent alternative. And actually, in comparing the costs, one analysis we did looks like it's about the same cost. One suggests that it might even be a lower cost alternative. From our perspective, we have a procedural problem here. As Representative Anderson explained, if a high voltage line is longer than 10 miles, law is real clear. Need has to be proved. You can't build a high voltage line without first finding out, is there something less that you could do that would solve the need? As initially proposed, this line was 8 miles, and as it went through the process, it became clear that some of the alternatives that would go on busier streets might make it 10 miles long. And at that point, the Public Utilities Commission said they wanted to have an evidentiary hearing. But as the expert testimony began to come forward, including a public hearing that was just a couple weeks ago, what we learned is that unless a bill like this one, House File 1205 or the Senate file, passes, Xcel says that they will go ahead and route the line, and if it comes out that the route is 8 miles or even 9.9 miles long, they won't have to show that there's a need for any kind of a high voltage line at all. They'll just go ahead and build it. And that's the gap in procedure that this bill would solve. The other problem that we see, and I don't know if there are members of this committee who are also working on the transmission rider, is that Xcel has said if they build the high voltage line, they get to use the transmission rider, which was intended for wind. So there's a financial incentive. If they use the underground solution, there is no such incentive. From our perspective, the process and the incentives are backwards. They seem to be pushing towards the high voltage line rather than a low voltage alternative for which there was unanimous community support. We provided a packet and we've got a couple other testifiers, so I'll wrap up. First, we believe the Xcel proposed high voltage line is not needed. We believe Xcel's own studies that go to 2030, also an environmental report of the Department of Commerce, and the testimony of an electrical engineer all say is that the underground low voltage alternative with a new substation but no high voltage lines would be a feasible and available alternative to meet the need. Second, which is relatively unusual, this high voltage line would come near a whole lot of homes. There are 289 homes within 200 feet, and there are 62 homes within 50 feet. That is much closer than many of the other high voltage lines that are also in some relationship to homes. Also, this is a pretty important wetlands area, and at least according to Excel's estimate, there are 16 poles that would have to be built right in the middle of wetlands, many of which are in the Minnehaha Creek watershed. And we have expert testimony from both an environmental consultant and the engineer that says if we went with A2, the alternative that Excel mapped out in its own study, that the impacts on homes and residents and the environment could be avoided, and it's likely that it would be a comparable, if not a lesser, cost. So we believe that this bill will fix the process and ensure that an unnecessary power line is not built in the communities of Plymouth and Medina. We ask for your support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Madam Chair, Representatives. Thank you so much for the time. My name is Dana Murray. I am a realtor with Keller Williams, and my business is focused mostly in the western suburbs. I am a professional at what I do. I was recently named the 2013 Best Realtor in Plymouth, Wayzata, and Minnetonka, and I am beginning my 10th year in the real estate business. Last year, I sold over 40 homes. I understand the market and the conditions and those that will affect pricing. The public perceives a high-voltage power line as a risk, and therefore the perception becomes reality for someone trying to sell a house. Days in market are increased, and usually the price is decreased. Whether or not there is specific evidence or scientific evidence that power lines are hazardous, it doesn't really matter. What the public perceives becomes reality. Many comments I have received from the public were things such as, I would never buy a house backing up to a high-voltage power line. I'd pay 33% less. There are too many health risks. Resale risk, totally not worth it. I also spoke to the other top four agents in our office, and their responses were all very similar. They basically moaned and shared that they had all sold homes with power lines, high-voltage power lines, behind them, but they had taken much longer to sell and receive a lot less money. Most said it averaged between 10 and 15%. The sales price for a home backing up to a power line is that similar, according to appraisers, of what would be like a major highway in front of your house or behind your house or major industry. Location, location, location. You always hear that, and this holds true very much backing up to a high-voltage power line. Interestingly, the FHA financing will not allow a mortgage to be funded for a home that's within the fall line of a high-voltage power line. In the past 4 years, approximately 70% of the financing for homes that I have sold have been FHA. That would remove a huge amount of possibilities of buyers to purchase homes in those areas. I also looked at a small sample of homes along the power line area up in Katy, along a street called Katy in St. Michael, because I had sold a home there. The average days on market for homes backing up to the power lines was 203. The average days on market for the other properties in that same area, not backing up the power lines, was 43. Statistically, we know the longer a home is on the market, the lower the price goes. No buyer has ever commented on underground lines, the big red green boxes sometimes in the neighborhoods. No one has ever mentioned those to me as I'm showing homes as a hazard or concern for resale. The alternate option of laying underground lines would be preferred way to solve the need for this more energy, they're saying is needed, for health, aesthetic, and financial reasons. Thank you so much for your time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate McBride. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify today. I live in Plymouth in a home I purchased with my husband Scott about 20 years ago. We raised our two children there. More than 1.5 years ago, I and a few of my neighbors began to fully appreciate that Excel's proposed new high voltage transmission line would forever alter the character of our neighborhood. We reached out for help and support from others in the community. The response has been overwhelming. Over and over again, we heard from other Plymouth residents that they, too, are concerned that the 115 kV lines and their 90-foot steel poles will destroy the ambiance and character of our residential neighborhoods because they are unsightly and noisy and because they will cause the loss of trees and mar our existing wetlands. But by far, the biggest concern of the residents is the documented health concerns over magnetic fields that emanate from a fully energized high-voltage line. These proposed lines will come within 100 feet or less of people's homes, their homes, not their houses. We know that there is epidemiological evidence to suggest that magnetic fields created by power lines are associated with an increased risk of childhood leukemia and other health concerns that threaten the safety of our families. Because of that threat and the other mentioned impacts, we know too that our property values will suffer. For most of us, including myself, our homes are the biggest investment of our lives. We work very hard for them. We know that we will not be able to sell those homes for near what they're worth if the lines cut through our neighborhoods. We also know that many will just simply leave the neighborhood because they cannot take the risk of living near a high-voltage transmission line. The Plymouth City Council has joined the community in its opposition to the 115 kV lines. The council unanimously passed a resolution urging a full fact-finding hearing to determine if a low-voltage distribution alternative can provide reliable energy needs to meet our community's needs. As you've heard, that low-voltage distribution alternative does indeed exist. Even Xcel's own load-serving study has identified it as an option, and the Department of Commerce has said it is feasible and available. But now, Xcel is on record as saying that even if the Public Utility Commission finds that it has failed to prove need, it nevertheless is entitled to go forward with the routing of that line without consideration of the low-voltage alternative. This is so because the proposed line is less than 10 miles, as you heard. But it is Xcel that subdivided its line upgrades, and thus it is Xcel that was able to dictate that its 8.8-mile project was just short enough to having to prove a need for a new 115 line. Without passage of the bill, the residents of Plymouth will be robbed of their chances to have that available and feasible low-voltage alternative considered, even if the greater weight of evidence shows that it will meet our community's needs. How can that be? How is that due process for the citizens? Until today, we have really felt like pawns in a system that does not seem to care about our health or welfare. But I believe that government can do great things. And so on behalf of the residents of Plymouth and the surrounding area, I urge you to support the bill today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I just have one more testifier, and I appreciate your patience. I really do.
We'll just give equal time to the other side. Go ahead and state your name and then proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Alan Napier. I'm a resident in Plymouth, and the power lines are right in my backyard, or the proposed power lines, the transmission lines are right in my backyard. This is obviously a very important matter to the citizens of Plymouth. If you'll allow me to address the impact of the high voltage transmission lines versus the lower voltage distribution lines, purely on a monetary basis as it pertains to our real estate investments. First of all, in all of the unbiased studies that I've read, distribution power lines, as advocated by the Hallidale distribution alternatives, don't impact property values. But high voltage transmission lines do directly impact property values. In most studies that I've read, the impacted properties extend 200 to 400 meters from the center line of the power line. This is far further than the 200 feet that are specified within the Xcel and Department of Commerce impact documents that you've seen so far. Having said that, the impact of properties identified by Xcel, Department of Commerce, using the Department of Commerce impact numbers, the estimated impact is approximately $14 million to the residents of Plymouth and Medina. And there are only 289 of those properties impacted. How did I figure that out? Well, I went to the tax records and looked up the market value for each of the 263 residences that are east of Brockton Lane on the proposed high voltage transmission line. Those property values had a total value of $80 million, and at the impact level of the Department of Commerce, that comes out to be about $11 million. Those properties west of Brockton are going to add about another $20 million. I couldn't isolate that. Comes out to a total of $14 million. That's a lot of money for the residents to lose for an unnecessary power line. The literature, as you've heard, also suggests a much longer time to sell the properties, both those properties that are directly impacted, those are the 289 that we just discussed, but also adjacent properties, especially when realtors reference comparables, and in those comparables are directly impacted properties. Thank you very much for consideration of Representative Anderson's bill, and we would very much appreciate your support.
Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience here to testify either for or against the bill or to provide information? Somebody from Excel, perhaps? Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Just a couple of observations on the bill. First of all, the need for the transmission upgrade in this area is driven by the need to serve the load that is growing in that area and to do it reliably. We go through, you know, a fairly extensive process of identifying the and engineering the solutions to the load problems that we're having there, and then we propose alternatives to the Public Utilities Commission. The earlier testifiers are correct. There is a distribution level fix to the problem. In this case, as usually is the case with a distribution fix, it is a short-term fix, and we expect that within 4 or 5 years we will be back looking for the transmission fix, and we'll have spent the money on the distribution fix. So we understand that building transmission is one of the hardest things we do. We interfere with everybody along the way, and we understand that that's one of the problems with having to build transmission. In this particular case, this is a obviously a difficult thing for the neighbors to contemplate happening, but from an engineering point of view, we feel it's necessary. I will say that ordinarily, because the line that we have that's currently under contemplation is less than 10 miles long, under state law we're not required to do a certificate of need. We did in this case agree to do a certificate of need, in part because we knew that it was important to the neighbors that we do so, and in part because there were solutions, transmission solutions to the problem that were greater than 10 miles long. And so we felt in our interpretation of the statute that a certificate of need would be appropriate where some of the solutions would exceed the length required under Minnesota law. So we have agreed to do the certificate of need. I'm not entirely sure what some of the testifiers were referring to, but if the PUC were to find that there is no need for the line, I can assure you we would not build it. We are not interested in spending money to build things that are not needed. If the line is found to be needed, and we believe that it will be, then the routing process goes on. In this particular case, the routing process is traveling behind the need process, but it is not waiting for the need process. And I know that that's a matter of some concern that we perhaps slow one down until we finish the first, but frankly, the engineers and all are fairly confident, I would say supremely confident, that the need is going to be there. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
My concern is that other Xcel ratepayers would have to pay for a temporary solution and a permanent solution later on. I'm an Xcel ratepayer in the city of Brooklyn Park. And so I guess I don't really have a question for you, Mr. Evans, but Representative Anderson, I think my committee administrator got in touch with you about the oral amendment I'd be offering. Senator Bonhoff called me at home this weekend and strongly encouraged me to move the bill. And I went over the proposed oral amendment with her, and she said she agreed with it and she would fight to keep it in conference. And it's only on condition that it's included that I would be voting in favor of the bill. And it would be at line 1.15 after the word feasible to insert comma cost effective.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I'll take that as a friendly amendment.
All those in favor of the proposed oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any other questions or comments by members? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess part of a question here, but to my understanding, a 115 line really isn't all that uncommon or that large. I mean, it's not like you've got the huge superstructures. It's, you know, typically wooden pole, three lines. I don't, you know, when you look at different line structures, this doesn't seem to be that really large compared with the 345 kV super high voltage lines that we've got with the CapEx project. So I guess my question is, why should we be applying this standard to a relatively small line when we don't apply the same standard to the massive transmission lines that affect, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people and have huge implications and actually have significantly more impact with respect to potential health benefits?
Well, Representative Falk, I'm not really crazy about this bill. I mean, I see it as a sort of a not in my backyard, but I understand that it's important to the people whose backyards it's in, and if it is cost-effective, then I'm fine. The precedent I worry that we're setting with a bill like this is that every neighborhood that's unhappy about a decision made by a utility comes in and asks the legislature to make an adjustment, and we don't have the expertise or training to make that call, and that's why I think it's important that the PUC determine that it's cost effective.
It still is just an interesting precedent we're potentially setting here. I mean, because once again, this is a relatively small line and it's not operating at the highest of high voltages, but we go and give free pass basically to, you know, the largest lines, which have much larger impacts. And I'm just curious if the author thinks that maybe perhaps this should be applied, the same litmus test should be applied to those very large lines.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Falk, we're going from a 69 kilovolt line to 115, so you're basically almost, you know, well, you're doubling the size of the line that is going through these neighborhoods. As the testimony was provided earlier, there are 62 homes that are within 50 feet of this line. I would love it if you had a chance to come out to my district. I know we have very very different districts from the one that you represent, being largely rural versus mine being a metropolitan district. But the fellow, Mr. Napier, who had testified here earlier today, if you go out on his deck and say this is the corner of his deck, the line is that close on the corner of that table. So if that gives you kind of some perspective of, you know, what we're looking at, it would be double the size, essentially, of the line. But I don't know if Ms. McAbee has further comments that she wants.
Well, Representative Falk, I think both you and Representative Anderson should come to my house because I have a 345 kilovolt line running through my front yard.
That's the point I make. I mean, essentially, the construction of a 69 or 115 can be identical. You might have ever so slightly longer insulators on there, but you can use the same pole structure and, you know, You could look at two identical ones and you couldn't differentiate between the two of them in many instances. Now, granted, it's not just a doubling of the voltage. I mean, you got a huge amount more electric current flowing through there because of, you know, it's a cubic and there's, you know, a whole bunch of electrical engineering, which I'm not going to get into. But, I mean, this is a relatively small line compared to the 230s or 345s, which are being proposed. So I'm just asking, why wouldn't we want to go and apply the same level of concern to those very high voltage transmission lines when this one is, you know, for all intents and purposes, relatively small.
Ms. McAbee.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, I share your concern about the CapEx 345 kV lines. The procedure in that case, though, there at least was a certificate of need. I may disagree with the conclusions that were reached after all the evidence, but it did get a chance to go through the process. I think what's interesting about this line is the proximity of homes. There are 62 homes within 50 feet of the 115 kV line. That's actually outside the right-of-way for a 345. I would say that this is a slightly different legal procedural issue, though your point that perhaps other power lines need to be looked at more closely is one that I would support. And I know there's some rulemaking going on, and I intend to pay attention to that because I think there are legitimate issues and questions about what is the most efficient way of meeting need, and in some cases it might even be more cost effective to me need in a different way. So,
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess to the authors, I mean, what is the concern? Is it the electromagnetic field? Is it just the size of the line? I mean, essentially, if it's going to be the same poles, you know, and if you're not going to really notice much of a difference, maybe there's a plan to change the different pole structure. But, I mean, what is the concern?
Representative Falk, you know, we had pretty extensive testimony that you may
I apologize.
That's
I was
right. You may have been presenting your bill, but I don't think we want to have people restate. I think there was a concern about resale value and a perception, whether it's real or not, that there's some harm related to electromagnetic fields.
Okay.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That actually gets into what my comment was going to be. I understand the real estate issue and the comment about perception equaling reality from that point of view, but it seems like this issue is primarily one of a not in my backyard, and it's not really the job of this committee to reinforce public perception that's not supported by evidence from the public health point of view, not from the real estate value point of view. And another comment was made about underground lines, and you can't necessarily just put lines underground, particularly you can't put them through a wetland underground. But we have underground lines in my neighborhood, and they're great to begin with, and they're very costly to maintain as they get older. So I would just encourage people to separate the two issues of the real estate value from the actual public health issue. Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to Ms. McAbee. When you talk about 50 feet to the power line, are you talking about to the edge of the right-of-way? Are you talking to the pole structures themselves?
Ms. McAbee.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I'm talking about the power line itself, the center line. And that's in this particular case, there are 289 homes less than 200 feet or less from the wire itself. And there will be all new poles. They will be built on metal poles. And in this case, the underground distribution lines would not be on the same alignment. They'd be on regular sidewalks. And it's not a proposal that the neighborhood are made up. It's a proposal that Excel had saying that the underground low-voltage distribution line alternative was feasible as long as they were able to build a new substation. So that's somewhat different in this case than it is in other cases.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I'm thinking about just the fall zone alone has got to be more than 50 feet. And so I'm choking on Ms. McAbee's assertion that how, because you said 50 feet from the poles to these people's homes, that something's not adding up here in my mind. And I'm not a power line construction expert. I just know that between line swing and the fall zone, there's got to be more than 50 feet from the edge of the right-of-way to somebody's house or deck. I see somebody wants to speak to that point, but I'm trying to rectify that in my mind, those comments.
Both Representative Anderson and Ms. McAbee would like to speak to it. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Beard. I believe in the packet that you received, it'll give you a visual of what we're talking about. If you look on whatever the third or fourth page there, you can see we're talking about distance-wise. And I don't know if Ms. McAbee wants to add to that.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative
Beard. Ms. McAbee.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard,
mm-hmm.
The numbers that were quoted in your packet are from an answer to information request that we made of Xcel Energy. So it's their numbers. It's not from us going out and measuring them. That isn't necessarily for all the power lines because the poles that may not all be within that are unlikely to have as many poles within that mm-hmm. distance of homes. Because I imagine they will space out the poles. That's distance from the wire. And I don't have data on exactly how close all the poles are to homes. I don't. So that number 62 was homes near the wire, not necessarily near the poles. So if I wasn't clear, I apologize.
Representative Beard.
And thank you. Just one follow-up. Excel, by their testimony, Ms. McAbee said that they have agreed voluntarily to a certificate of need. In this process, and we're moving ahead with this. Why, then, if they're doing that?
Ms. McAbee.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, in public testimony on March 7th, Citizens and the administrative law judge tried to clarify what the procedure would be, and Excel basically said if the eventual, they will go ahead, they, the certificate of need might be quote-unquote denied simply on the basis that it's not 10 miles long without evaluating the two choices, and then if their chosen route is anything less than 10 miles, if it's 9.9 miles, then they will say, they told the administrative law judge and the 50 or 60 citizens that were there on the record that they would go ahead and route that line without first weighing out the evidence to see if the distribution alternative that's in their study would meet the need. So we're not saying right now this committee should decide that the distribution alternative meets the need. We're just saying we want that fact-finding evidence to go forward and not get shortchanged if somehow the line isn't, you know, is a block too short or something.
Further questions by members or discussion? Okay, seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 1205 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, we have a change in our agenda tomorrow. Our committee administrator tried to make the change online, and I guess there's something not going great with the website. And so we are going to be having a review of the solar rewards program that Excel currently has and the current Made in Minnesota solar bonus program. And we're removing House File 893 about propane suppliers. We'll work on that bill next year. So any... Seeing no further discussion by members of the committee, we're adjourned.